I thought it would make sense for us to start by reviewing from Perek Chaf, from chapter 20, just because it's been quite a few weeks since we last learned. I apologize to those who are listening to this after the fact as a recording and had the benefit of doing so right after the previous week's shiur. So for you, you can just jump past this review, but for us, I think it's necessary. So, if you look at the source sheet, I gave you it's just that list of review questions that I had provided at the end last time. It starts out with the following. Yehonatan insists that his father does not want to kill David. Does this ring a bell? Right? This should ring a bell. Overall, the theme of the chapter that we dealt with was the test of Shaul. Does he really want to kill David? As well as the test of Yehonatan by David, is Yehonatan really going to be loyal to me? Is he going to side with me, or is he going to side with Shaul? So the chapter began by Yehonatan insisting that his father doesn't want to kill David. And the way the conversation goes, it sounds like David is part of palace life. David says it's going to be Rosh Chodesh and I'll be missed. It sounds like he's generally part of life at Shaul's palace, which makes no sense, because in chapter 19, Shaul tried to kill him at least three times. So we gave different explanations for how it could be that David could be back at the palace, ranging from the idea that Shaul actually did tshuva. In his encounter with Shmuel, he repented. That was a wild idea. A more reasonable and rational read of it would be to simply say that David has no choice. David has to remain around the palace, either because he wants to avoid being labeled a fugitive, because if he's called a fugitive, then everybody's going to be after him, or because he has this covenant with Yehonatan, and it requires that he stay with Yehonatan, and that was borne out in the chapter itself, where David appeals to Yehonatan, saying, if you have mercy on me at all, let me go, indicating that Yehonatan is actually the one who's keeping David around. So then we asked, how can Yehonatan think that Shaul doesn't want to kill David? David says, your father wants to kill me, and Yehonatan says, no, he doesn't. He would tell me if he was planning anything at all. How in the world can Yehonatan be so ignorant and so blind? And we gave two points. Number one, that Shaul, when he surrounded Michal's house to get David, pretended he was just trying to get David back to the palace. That's number one. He didn't necessarily tell Yehonatan. And number two, the suggestion that Yehonatan thinks that what his father is doing is a function of his ruach ra'ah. It's a function of that spirit that has overtaken him, this depression that he has over losing the throne and losing his connection with God. That's what's driving it. And that's only periodic. It's not constant. And therefore, David can escape it. Yes, Susan.
Didn't we also say that we didn't know how long Yehonatan was around the palace, and maybe he just was unaware?
Right. We floated the idea in general that Yehonatan may not be around the palace. It's a little hard still to think that he would be entirely ignorant of what's going on. But yes, we did note the possibility that he's out with his troops somewhere. That was a suggestion. Thank you. Does any of this, by the way, sound familiar to people? I mean, clearly it sounds familiar to Susan. Okay, I've got some heads shaking yes. I'm assuming that all the people whose screens are off, their heads are shaking yes behind the screens. That's my assumption. So, continuing on the source sheet, right, we then moved into the test that was proposed. Nanette, thank you for the thumbs up. We move into the test that was proposed, this Rosh Chodesh test. Let's see if Shaul gets angry when I don't show up. And we asked, why would Shaul be angry when David does not show up? And we suggested it was because David's absence frustrates him. Now he can't kill him. Also, is an excuse for Shaul to label David as a fugitive. But David says to Yehonatan, as part of presenting the test, if I've wronged you, better you to kill me than your father. We asked, does David really believe that Yehonatan wants to kill him? And what we said is that David would have reason to think Yehonatan wants David to be in danger. Yehonatan is keeping him there. David thinks it's obvious that his father wants to kill him. Maybe, yeah. Maybe Yehonatan is really against me. And Yehonatan reacts as though, indeed, he thinks David is serious. He's wounded by the accusation. So they make a new pact with each other. Yehonatan says, I'm going to protect you, and you protect my children. We asked, does that mean that Yonatan is taking a pragmatic approach? He wants to help himself. Is that what this is all about? And our answer was that generally he is assumed to be sincere and pure in his motivation, but he could still be asking for something for his descendants. I know you're getting the throne, so please look after my descendants on my behalf. And then we noted that David did not respond to that request for a pact, and we suggested that it may be because it could be he's being sensitive. I don't want to acknowledge that I'm going to be king. But it could also be that he still suspects Yehonatan of loyalty to Shaul. So that plan, the actual attempt to figure out what it is that Shaul wants and what it is that Yehonatan's motivation is. So Yehonatan describes, the way the plan works is that Yehonatan is going to be at the palace. Shaul is going to notice that David is absent. When he asks Yonatan what the story is with David, Yonatan will say to him, he was called away, right? He was called away for a family celebration back home. There's a family karban to be brought. And so David isn't here, and see what happens. See whether Shaul responds angrily or not. And then if Shaul responds calmly, acceptingly, then he goes out and he shoots an arrow that is short of the spot where David is hiding and says, come back, and David can come back. Or he shoots arrows further away, indicating that that Shaul got angry, David is in danger and he should flee. And so he should give him the sign by shooting the arrow further away and telling the youth, they're farther away, go run after them. We talked about why he has two different symbols that he's giving. One, the speech, the words he's going to say, and the other, the arrows, and suggested that perhaps the point of doing that is because there's a third possibility. Perhaps Shaul does not give a clear signal. Things, in fact, are ambiguous. So he gives these symbols. We talked about switching the fact that he calls the youth a nar, then he calls the youth an elem, and that may be the second signal. Whether he calls him a nar or calls him an elem, I don't want to go back over that. It's a fairly minor point within the chapter. We asked why there's a need for the whole arrow thing at all. If everything is fine, just run out and say, David, you're free. But we noted that there's a fear that he'll look like he's been conspiring with David, and that's never good, even if David is safe. And then finally, the sets of three, the 3 days, the three arrows, the three parts of the field, the three bowings, suggested parallels between Yosef and the dreams of the butler and baker and what's going on here. And it fits into the parallels that we have between Yosef and David. Am I going too fast, or is this working for you? We're good? Okay. So then we get to what actually happens. Shaul is sitting by the wall. We noted different reasons why he's sitting by the wall, whether it's a seat of honor or whether it's to show that he's afraid. But he's sitting by the wall. And sure enough, David is not there the first day. Shaul does not react, potentially because he knows that Yehonatan sympathizes with David. And therefore, he doesn't want to say anything yet. He doesn't want to alert his son and arouse that sympathy. However, David continues to be gone. And Shaul says, where is the son of Yishai? A term which is a diminutive. He's putting down David. He doesn't get his own name. Or alternatively, he's saying, David is the son of Yishai. You are my son. And it's a statement of, yeah, why are you loyal to the son of Yishai? You should be loyal to me. So Yehonatan responds when his father lashes out with his chanit, which, by the way, we're going to talk a lot more about that chanit in the coming chapters this year, God willing. But he lashes out at Yehonatan, and Yehonatan still tries to make peace and tries to calm Shaul down. But fundamentally, this is over. And so Yehonatan comes back to David, and he shoots the arrows, but instead of David seeing the arrows are shot far away, and Yehonatan says what he's supposed to say, and David fleeing, he waits for the youth to be gone, and then he comes out and embraces Yehonatan. And we suggested that may either be because they realize nobody's around, so hey, we can. Or they're just overcome with emotion, and that leads them to drop the practical plan. But the conclusion is that they cry, and it says David cries more than Yehonatan, or David cries more, which we explained either meant that David cried excessively because of his fear, or alternatively, David cried even more than Yehonatan, showing emotion, which in previously Yehonatan was the emotional one, but now David is. Susan.
When we talked about Yehonatan and David, you know, like the path and take care of my children, wasn't there also, I'm not sure, but an inference that Yehonatan would have to support his father and he may get killed. And therefore, I thought we talked about that, and therefore he's asking David to take care of his children because he can't fight on David's side. I remember commenting, it reminds me of Camelot. Because I remember we said that Yehonatan knew he'd have to support his father.
So what you may be thinking of is something that we're going to reference on the first pasuk in the next parak, but we mentioned it already previously about the fact that he is going to stay with his father. But the idea of him protecting Yehonatan's children is fundamentally, you're going to be the king. And it isn't necessarily a statement that Yehonatan is going to die. It doesn't have to be so. That's the way I would read it. Ricky. No, now you muted yourself. You had already unmuted. There you go.
I had it before. Okay, when they meet, they fall on the ground. Do they bow to each other? Is that permitted?
So they hug. I didn't think they bowed to each other.
It says here, Vayishtachu.
Oh, then I forgot it. Yeah. So in answer, yeah, no, you're right. I do see that there. Vayishtachu shalosh pamim. There is that. And I mentioned it, the three bowings. You're right. But the answer is yes. Bowing is a sign of respect. It's not an act of worship. Yeah. Okay. You see it numerous times in Tanakh. Yes, Eti.
I'm picking up on the fact that David is supposed to protect Yonatan's children.
Yeah.
When potential heirs go against his new rule. So now he's swearing to Yonatan that he's not going to do such a thing, he's going to protect his children.
Right. So what are you asking?
No, I'm not asking. I'm saying that might be a reason that why Yehonatan asks him to protect his children.
Oh, yeah. I mean, also because this is the Middle East. You know, when you get a new king from a new family come along,
yeah,
we know what happens to the previous king's family. His concern has substance to it, and especially given David's suspicion of Yehonatan, which he's voiced. So there's that as well. So let's move into this chapter. Let's see what we can do with it. Unlike the chapters that we looked at last year, this chapter, this parak, really may be understood as just David's story. Meaning previous prakim talked about stories which had multiple layers. It was a story about Shaul and about Yehonatan and about David. This story here is really just David's story. It's a short parak. We haven't had a parak this short yet, I think. But it has multiple layers to it in terms of what David has to do to escape from Shaul. Because in our chapter, David is cut loose. David is now a fugitive. He's out there in the world, and he has to survive. And this is extremely difficult for him. If you take a look at the outline I actually gave you on the sheet, it's going to open with a sentence which we referenced already in the beginning of the summer about Yehonatan's losses. We're going to come back and explain that. And then David is a fugitive, and he's going to sneak help from the Mishkan in Nov. Quick show of hands, whether your screen is on or your screen is off. How many of you have actually read through this chapter? recently. Okay, I've got one there. No, okay. So the vast majority of not, which means that this is going to be a spoiler. I do recommend seeing it in advance. It really helps to understand what's going on. But David is going to go to the city of Nov, which is where the Mishkan, the tabernacle, is. And he's going to go to somebody who seems to be the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. And he's going to tell him, I am on a mission from Shaul, but it's a secret mission. I can't tell you anything about it. You can't tell anybody about it. And I need you to give me food and a weapon. He's going to lie. And he's going to descend in various ways from the image one might have of a pure and righteous David through the Perek. And those are the layers that I see here. So first of all, he's going to deceive Achimelech, this Kohen Gadol, about his mission. Then he's going to use property of the Mishkan in questionable ways, because the food he's going to get is some kind of sacred bread, as we have to talk about. He is going to get a sword, but not just any sword. I know, Jeanette, you saw the chapter already. Whose sword is he going to get from the Mishkan?
Goliath.
Goliath's sword. Goliath, who was the anti-David, right? When we learned about him in chapter 17. They were opposites in every way. Now he's going to wield the sword of Goliath. Then, a step I never would have expected, never would have seen coming, he's going to turn to the He's going to turn to the Philistines for help. The Philistines. The people he's been fighting against, massacring the people who hate him. He's going to turn to the Philistines for help, and in order to survive among the Philistines, he's going to pretend to have lost his mind. He is going to go from being fair-haired boy, everything is wonderful, he's amazing, he has all the traits that we listed for him back in chapter 16, sentence 18, to being somebody you can't even recognize. So that's the challenge of this chapter here. And the questions that I ponder as I read this chapter, and I don't have answers yet for some of them, for at least in full, is, number one, does David really need to do all the things that he does here? All the steps that he takes, the deceptions, is that all necessary? That's one question. And number two, how will the steps he takes here affect David's conduct later in his reign? Because things with David always come back. What happens in one chapter is relevant later on. So we're going to have to see what the impact is of this further along. Yes, Ricky.
I was wondering about the sword.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't read the chapter. Am I going to find out what happened to it after?
Yeah. Well, you know what happened to it before already, because it was in chapter 17. They told you about him going on tour, and we talked about him bringing the head back to Yerushalayim, and we had this whole discussion about when that happened. But the sword is on display here, basically since that battle. Well, not necessarily on display, but we'll talk about that. Okay. So in order to begin this properly, we need first a discussion about the Mishkan. The Mishkan is now in Nov. Where was it before it was in Nov?
Shiloh,
right. What can you tell me about the Mishkan in Shiloh? What was the Mishkan like in Shiloh in terms of the relationship with the people and all of that? Like, what was the Mishkan like?
Well, we heard at the beginning of Shmuel that not many people were coming.
Right. So first point, Jeanette notes, people were not going to the Mishkan when the Mishkan was in Shiloh. We even had the Medrash about Elkanah trying to get other people to go. You know, Eli has time to just sit there at the entrance and have a conversation with Chana, even though he's Kohen Gadol and Shofet, it appears. And then you have Eli's sons, Chofni and Pinchas, who are abusing the Mishkan as though it were their private fiefdom. The Aron is totemized, right? It's a totem. It's a good luck charm. They're going to take it to war against the Philistines as a way to seek victory. And then, of course, they lose the Aron. Do you remember what happened when the Aron was returned? This is a long time ago. This was like chapter 6. So, you know, this is years since we saw this. Anybody remember?
What didn't happen? The Jews didn't come out to celebrate.
Ricky remembers. The Jews did not come out to celebrate. Not only that, they didn't go after the Aron. They didn't go off in the first place, and they didn't come out to celebrate. They are, as we saw in the commentators, out working their fields. Oh, look, Aron over there, cow's pulling it. And they got punished for it. They got punished for that. So the state of things with the Mishkan was, you know, when it was in Shiloh, was pretty poor. Then, after Shiloh. So it's unclear what exactly happens in terms of the establishment of the Mishkan in Shiloh. What we do know from chapter 7 is that Shmuel leads some kind of national renaissance, religious renaissance, in chapter 7, at some point in a 20-year period. Right? Does this ring a bell? I mean, it's not going to ring a bell for people who joined after chapter 7 unless you went back and listened to the recordings, which I do recommend because they weren't so bad. But if you look back at chapter 7, sentence 2, the Aron is in a place called Kiryat Ye'arim because of problems when the Aron first came back. The people of Beit Shemesh were suffering. So chapter 7, sentence 2. Vayihi, and it was. Miyom Sheves Ha'aron B'Kiryat Ye'arim, from the day when the Aron stayed in Kiryat Ye'arim. Vayirbu Hayamim, time went by. Vayihyu Esrim Shana, and 20 years elapsed. Vayinahu Kobes Yisrael Acharei Hashem, and the people followed God. So the question is, it was 20 years and then the people followed God? Or at some point during the 20 years, they came back to God, and eventually 20 years elapsed. So most commentators assume that the people are following God before the 20 years have elapsed. It's just that there was a 20-year period that the Aron was in Kiryat Ye'arim before finally it goes to Yerushalayim. That's a standard read. Well, the Mishkan is not in Kiryat Ye'arim. The Mishkan is in Nov. What is Nov? So Nov is a city of Kohanim. It's located in the land of the tribe of Binyamin. Remember that the southern, but all of Israel's south, all the way up to Yerushalayim, belongs to Yehuda. Immediately north of Yehuda, you have Binyamin. You have Dan in the west, Binyamin in the east. And so parts of Yerushalayim and points north are Binyamin territory, and the Mishkan is in Nov, which is in Binyamin territory, near Yerushalayim. It is a city of Kohanim. Some of you learned Yehoshua with me. That's a while ago. When we did Yehoshua, we talked about the cities of the Levim around the land of Israel, and the Kohanim have their own cities where their shifts live. They go to the base, to the Mishkan, and then Beis HaMikdash in shifts. So this is the city of Kohanim in Binyamin. Take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 2. This is a medrash in Seder Olam that gives you a chronology for when the Mishkan was in Nov. B'tchilas elu ha'esrim shana heviu es ohel moed lenov. In the beginning of the 20-year period, they brought the ohel moed, this tent of meeting that's the Mishkan, to Nov. V'av al-pi shahaya aron Hashem b'kiryat ye'arim. Even though the Ark, the Aron, is still staying in Kiryat Ye'arim. B'Nov hayu makriven kol yud gimel shana. They spent 13 years bringing karbanos in Nov. V'zayin shanim b'givon, and then another 7 years in Givon. Anybody know why the Mishkan moved from Nov to Givon? Oops. Someone's got to be muted. There we go. Okay. So the Mishkan moves from Nov to Givon because of the events of this chapter and the next chapter. As a result of chapters 21 and 22, the Mishkan will be destroyed in Nov, and it's going to move to Givon. More than that, I won't say, but hopefully people will read ahead. So the Mishkan is in No for 13 years, which means our story is now taking place 13 years after the destruction of Shiloh. And then, as source number two continues, 7 years in Givon. And then, Besof Esrim, at the end of 20 years, Hela David es Aron Hashem Kiryat Yarim El Beis Oved Adom Agiti. At that point, David brings the Aron from Kiryat Yarim, and we get the whole story that we'll see, God willing, in Shmuel Beis, B'mehera B'Yameinu. So, what you see here is that the Mishkan is now in Nov, but the Aron is not there. Aaron's not there. Now, the truth is, you know that because of this chapter 7, where we already said the Aaron is in Kiryat Yarim for 20 years, and the belief is that those 20 years are until David. As a matter of fact, we saw Ralbag, and I brought him for you on the sheet in source number 3, the Hebrews at the bottom of one side, and then goes over onto the English on the next side, which tells us that the Aaron stood in the house of Avinadav for 20 years until David removed it. That's in Kiryat Yarim. That's the idea. So that's one basis for knowing the Aron is not there. The other basis for knowing the Aron is not there is in the psukim that I gave you in source number 4, Shmuel Beis chapter 6. If you have a Shmuel Beis, if you have a full Tanakh, you can look at it there, is going to tell us that when David gets the Aron from Kiryat Yarim, he sends his men to Baale Yehuda, which Rashi says is also known as a city called Ba'ala that was in Yehuda. And in the pasuk I sent you to in Yehoshua, in source number 4, we find out that that city is Kiryat Yarim. So David is sending to Kiryat Yarim to get the Aron. By the way, interesting side note, that means that the Aron was in Yehuda while the Mishkan was in Binyamin. Right? Kiryat Yarim is a city in Yehuda. Nov is a city in Binyamin. That's the whole Rachaleya thing. It's the whole Shaul David thing. Right? It's that split. You follow me? Everyone's very quiet. Okay, so let me explain. We've talked a lot about Rachel and Leah and this split between their descendants and the influence it has. And we talked about it especially when David was chosen as king, replacing Shaul. Shaul is from Binyamin. Binyamin is from Rachel. David is from Yehuda, which is from Leah. So Leah replaces Rachel. What we're now seeing is that the Aron, during this interim period, was actually in Kiryat Yarim, which is a city in Yehuda, while the Mishkan was in Nov, which is in Binyamin. So it's just another example of the division. That's all. I thought that was interesting. But
I just want to ask you one question because I'm confused. I looked at my map and Nov is not on it. So does it get destroyed?
Yes.
That's why they didn't put it on the map.
I guess.
I
can't speak for your map, but Nov will be destroyed. Yep. You can look ahead at chapters 21, 22. I will never resent somebody looking ahead at the upcoming chapters. Just don't read the source sheet in advance. That's all. Yes, Eddie.
Who is Avinadav?
He's the one whose house the Aron is in Kiryat Yarim.
Yeah, but is he somebody special?
So you'd have to go back to the notes that we had on chapter 7, sentence 1 from way back when. I don't believe that I had a whole lot to say, but I might have. I don't remember offhand. I can barely remember what I said last week, let alone 4 years ago. Yes, Sandy. You have to unmute. Yep.
About that is that in number 3, in your notes number 3, that said that it already stood in the house of Avinadab for 20 years until David removed it. We were talking, I think, about wasn't that the Mishkan stood in the house of Avinadab?
No, it's the Aron. It's the Aron, the Ark.
The Aron?
Yeah.
But
lost. I'm sorry.
Yeah, David hasn't done it yet. He's going to do it in Shmuel
Bet. Sorry, that's what I was. Forgive me.
Yeah.
No problem. Okay.
But yeah, that hasn't happened yet. So, you know, Eti, when I get a chance, I'll take a look in my notes from what I did back on chapter 7. If I find anything interesting about Avinadav, Bli Neder, I'll bring it in the beginning of next class. But offhand, I don't remember.
I have a problem with my internet connection, and you keep fading, so I didn't hear what you said earlier.
Okay. So, I'm stressing this business of the Aron being in one place and the Mishkan being another because it's an interesting precedent. What's it a precedent for?
Mishkan?
No. The second Beis HaMikdash.
Yeah.
The second Beis HaMikdash doesn't have an Aron, right? And yet it's a Beis HaMikdash with a Kohen Gadol, with Karbanos. Because there you have it. You had Karbanos, you had a Kohen Gadol in the Mishkan in Nod, without an Aron. I should note that there is a commentator who disagrees with all of this about the Mishkan and the Aron. If I have to ask you who that's going to be, tell me who that's going to be. Sorry?
Abarbanel.
Right, of course it's going to be Abarbanel. Take a look at source number 5. Where Abarbanel goes entirely against the grain, without even telling you he's disagreeing with the world. He just says it as though it's obvious. Halach David el Nov, David went to Nov, Shenikran Noveh, which is actually called Noveh, as you'll see in the Psukim. Ushneim Echad, the same name. El Al-Chimelech HaKohen HaGadol, to Al-Chimelech the Kohen Gadol, Lefisha Haya Az Aron HaElokim Benov, because the Aron was in Nov. He wanted to pray there. He wanted to bow before God. He wanted to ask God, will I succeed? So as far as Abarbanel is concerned, of course the Aaron's in Nov, but he doesn't explain how he deals with the sources that we've talked about. So, I mean, it's going to fit in with his view of the 20 years, because he has a whole different view of the 20 years also. Like, he's going to tell you that Shmuel lives much longer than everybody thinks he lived. That the 20 years happened before the people's spiritual renaissance. Like, he's got all sorts of different ways to read things. Yes, Ricky.
Please excuse my ignorance, but I know what the Aron is, but what is the Mishkan?
So the Mishkan.
The Mishkan is where the Aron is all the time.
Is the tabernacle that the Jews build when they're in the wilderness in their second year there. While they're still at Har Sinai, it houses the Aron. It also houses the Shulchan, the table where they put the showbread, which we're going to talk about, not this week, but coming up. It houses the menorah. It houses the menorah. It houses the Mizbeach, the altar where you bring Karbanos. It's the place where God communicates with Moshe. Well, there's actually two tents, but I'll leave that. That's confusing. The bottom line, though, is the Mishkan travels with the Jews in the wilderness. Then when they arrive in Israel, it's first in a place called Gilgal, where they first camp. And then they move it to Shiloh in Sefer Yehoshua. And it's in Shiloh for 369 years until it's destroyed at the beginning of Shmuel.
Just a second. How can it be a Mishkan without an Aron? Isn't the Aron?
Thank you. That's exactly the point. We are learning here that it is possible to have a Mishkan with rituals and everything else, even without an Aron, and later in history, the Second Temple did not have the Aron, and yet it had rituals and so on anyway.
So are there any rituals where the Aron is, or is it just an object that is...
It's an object. No one even goes into the room where it is, except the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. That's it. Yes, Susan.
Urim and Tumim, do they stay with
Urim and Tumim stay with the Kohen Gadol? They're part of his garments. Yeah. Don't remove the Urim Batumim. It's a bad idea.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
So the Kodesh HaKodeshim had nothing in it?
Correct. It may have had poles, the poles that are usually attached to the Aron. That's it. Yes, so, Ruth.
Didn't the Aron have the Shnei Luchot HaBrit in it?
Yes. But that the Mishkan had neither. Yes, but it wasn't in the Mishkan. Yeah.
So that's the only thing that was in the Aron? It's the Shnei Luchot HaBrit?
Basically. There's a Gemara in Erevin that talks about having three things associated with the Aron. You have the broken set, possibly the complete set. There's a whole thing about one Aron, two Aronos. I'm not going into that right now. But the broken set, the second set, and Moshe's Sefer Torah. But that's a whole other discussion. I'm not going there right now. Sandy.
And so when the Aron was taken, it had all these items in it.
Yeah. Whatever's supposed to be in it is in it. That's correct. We actually did have, I should note, we had a discussion about this, that Shaul, we had a medrash that Shaul actually grabbed the Luchos out of the Aron when the Plishtim took it. And he ran back to Shiloh with the Luchos. They weren't in the Aron when the Plishtim got it. We did see that in a medrash. I do remember some things. Yes, Sandy.
Why would we not have tried to combine the two earlier? Like, in other words, as soon as the Aron was back, why not? Would they not have brought the Mishkan to the Aron or the Aron to the Mishkan? Like,
right.
They seem like they should be together in order, first of all, to unite the people. Second of all, they belong together.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. What would you think the answer is?
Politics.
I don't think so. I'd give a different answer based on what happened in chapter 6.
Proprietorship of, you know, it's
no, what happened in chapter 6 with the Aron?
We lost it.
We lost it in chapter 4. In chapter 6, when it comes back, the people of Beit Shemesh are the first ones to have it and they suffer.
Right.
And it ends up being sent to Avinadav and Kiryat Yarim, and Avinadav is fine. I think nobody wants to mess with it. That's what I think happened. I think they are afraid of the Aron. Go back to chapter 6, sentence 19. Look how many people died.
A lot.
Yes. 50,000 and 70, a whole discussion we had back then about the 50,000 and 70. But yeah, I think they don't want to mess with it. I think they want to just leave it right there. It's happy in Kiryat Yarim. Let's just leave it there. That's what I think. Okay. So while the Mishkan is in Nov, the Karbanos are actually decentralized. We've talked about this before, but just to refresh everyone's memory, take a look at source number 6. Where I numbered for you the places where the Mishkan was and noted the rules that changed as presented in the last chapter of Mishnah Zvachim. When the Mishkan was in Shiloh, they were not allowed to have bamot. A bama doesn't mean a stage like in modern Hebrew, although the words come from the same place. It's an elevated place. It means a private altar. So while the Mishkan was not in Shiloh, when the Mishkan was the original Mishkan in the wilderness, nobody could bring a karban, a sacrifice to God, an offering to God, in their own backyard. That was not allowed. Then the Mishkan is in Gilgal when they first enter into Israel, and Gilgal is a temporary thing. It's never intended to be permanent in any way, and therefore the Jews were allowed to bring karbanot elsewhere as they went about their travels, wars, and so on. Once they placed the Mishkan in Shiloh, once again we have a central site. You're not allowed to bring a karban in your backyard during Shiloh. Then you get to the destruction of Shiloh. The Aron is now, the Mishkan is now, I should say, in Nov. And again, Bamot are permitted. And when the Mishkan moves to Givon, they'll be permitted. The Beis HaMikdash is built. That's it. Everything's central. Everything in the Beis HaMikdash, and that never changes. So that's the
word. What kind of a word is Nov? I'm looking at the spelling.
It's a name. It's a name. I don't know. I don't know.
Why is it spelled with a hey?
So Noveh and Nov are the same thing. They're not two different things.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. So during this period of time, the Mishkan is not your central place for bringing a karban. Right? You see that. By the way, I had assumed, Ricky, when I read sentence 2, that David came noveh, that it's like when we add an ah to a word to say someone went there, like Mitzrayma is limitzrayim. But the commentators actually talk about Noveh as an alternative place name, so I don't know. But either way, no one has anything further that I've seen.
It has the three dots.
Yeah, that's Noveh. That's what makes it Noveh. So,
okay, would you say Nov?
Because Nov is the name. Yeah, you'll see as we go further. You'll see as we go further. So,
it does say it's instead of a lamed at the beginning, but it does mean no.
Okay, good.
Yeah, but it says Nov with
it. I want to stop focusing on the name because I want to focus on Nov itself and what's going on. We've seen over and over again the implementation of what we saw in source number 6, that karbanos could be brought anywhere. Can you tell me an example from Sefer Shmuel in which we saw that after the Mishkan in Shiloh was destroyed, somebody brought a karban on a local altar?
Well, that was after the war with the Plishtim.
Right, that's one example. One example, after the war with the Plishtim, Shaul sets up a Mizbeach.
Right.
How about before the war with the Plishtim, right?
Didn't Shmuel also go do that?
Shmuel brought lots of karbanos. When Shaul first met Shmuel, he had brought a karban back in chapter 9, you were correct, Ora. And after the war with Amalek, they have karbanos in chapter 15. And David, we said in the beginning of the class today, David gave the excuse of not being at the palace, saying, yeah, we have a family zevach. A zevach is assumed to be a karban, at home. So everyone's bringing karbanos everywhere. That's a really important point, which I want to come back to in a minute. But before we come back to it, can you tell me something about the relationship between the Mishkan and the Kohanim, therefore, and the king at this stage? Do we know anything about it?
I don't recall that we do.
So, I didn't recall at first either. Then I found one thing. I mean, the karbanos don't need a kohen, first of all, when you bring it on a bama, which means all these karbanos that are brought outside of the Mishkan can be brought without it being by a kohen. That's number one. But we did have one interaction that I found, which was back in chapter 14. You're going to kick yourself, Jeanette, because you'll remember it then. In chapter 14, the Jews are fighting against the Plishtim. The Plishtim are on the run. Shaul wants to know whether he should continue. What does he do?
The Urim and Tumim.
Correct. He inquires of the Urim and Tumim, which are being held by the Mashuach Muhammad, by the Kohen, at the battlefield. So that's all we know so far about the relationship between the Kohanim and the king, but that's going to be front and center in the next two chapters. Okay. So why do we care about all of this? Why is Torchiner spending a good half hour talking about the Mishkan in Nov? So I have three answers for that question. First of all, because this is Torah, and that's what we do here. So that's number one. But number two, because we're going to see something really curious happen in this chapter. Well, a few things. But jump to chapter 21, sentence 11. No, not 11. Sorry, sentence 8. I don't know why I said 11. Sentence 8. You see that sentence? What does it tell you?
Was being held.
Not being held, even though the word is ne'etzar, which has that connotation of something else is acting upon him. But it's not, it's assumed that it doesn't mean held, it means he is delayed there.
Delayed.
Right? Doeg, who works for Shaul, is hanging out at the Mishkan. So, hang on, Susan. So, you may recall, we've seen Doeg before. We've seen him in Medrash, we've seen him in Psukim, but Doeg, in the commentaries and rabbinic writings, is painted as a religious figure, not some servant for Shaul. And we've given some evidence for it before. I think one piece of evidence is the fact that he's at the Mishkan. Why in the world would he be at the Mishkan? You don't need to be at the Mishkan. You could bring a karban wherever you want. The Aron isn't at the Mishkan. Why is he there? Answer, Doeg is a religious figure. He's not just some servant of Shaul. So I think that's an important thing to consider as we read it. And then there's a third point, which to me is the most important. Susan, your question, and I'll keep everybody waiting for the most important point.
Doeg, first of all, I only remember seeing him in, we never saw actually his name. I remember being referred as he was something like the bad guy.
Oh, yes.
But he is the bad guy, so how can he be a religious figure?
Oh, we have to talk about that one.
The definition of religious.
So, right. We'll talk about that. We're not leaving that. I'm just pointing him out right now and his presence at the Mishkan. Have no fear. That will be a topic of conversation. Yeah, we don't like him. Oh, you're going to find out just how bad in this story. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, although he's also God's agent, as we'll see, but that's another story. We'll get there. The main reason why I wanted to emphasize all of this about the Mishkan at Nov is because there's a question that should be staring us in the face. And no one's mentioned it. I told you that David is a fugitive. David is out in the wind, right? Disavowed by the king who actually wants to kill him. Yonatan is not able to protect him. Tell me something. A fugitive from the king. What sort of place should he go? What sort of place does a fugitive go?
One of the cities where you can be protected.
Now, who's going to protect David?
No, in a city, he should be protected. There are cities.
Oh, a city of refuge? No, cities of refuge are for accidental murderers.
Yeah.
That's not a charge against David. David's charge is a rebel against the throne.
So he's going to a sanctuary, which is the Mishkan.
But he doesn't claim sanctuary.
Could he be going?
One second. Eti, your idea is a really good idea because we will see people in Shmuel Bet who are going to claim sanctuary at the Mishkan. But David is not doing that. David does not claim sanctuary. It was a good thought.
He could go to Shmuel Bet and
look for him as his enemies.
If I were David as a fugitive, I would say, go someplace inconspicuous. Go underground. Hide. Right, Jeanette, that was what you were going to say?
I was going to say that clearly that's where you're going, that he should have been going to some, like, hiding in the fields in situations where we do see him go.
Yeah. Why in the world does David go to the central spot for Jewish religious life? Why in the world do you go to the Mishkan? So there are two answers for this. I see your hands, but it's 2:20. So I'm going to just float an idea here. And then we'll come back to the questions and comments. First of all, David has something specific to gain. Take a look at chapter 22, sentence 10. 22:10. In 22:10, Doeg is going to tell Shaul that David was in the Mishkan in Nov.
That's what I was going to say.
Okay, but look at what he's going to say. Look what he's going to say. He reports what David did. And the first thing he says is Vayish'al lo Bashem, that David inquired of God. David inquired of the Urim v'Tumim. Now, that could have been an allegation of Doeg. It doesn't have to be true. But commentators assume that it is true. Abarbanel does. We already saw that. And if you take a look at source number 7, Ralbag says it as well, even though the text doesn't actually spell it out. But look at Ralbag in source number 7. He says it appears viyidme she David sha'alo beilokim im tatzliach darko shu holech ba. David asks God whether his path will succeed. Ki kvar nigla b'meshachar ze she David sha'alo beilokim. It will be shown later in chapter 22 that David inquired of God. Olafishu amar lachimelech ki amelech tivo. Okay, that's a separate point. We're not at that yet. I can tell you. It doesn't matter. He also says that since David told Achimelech, the Kohen, that the king told him, you know, don't tell anyone where you're going, so David was therefore able to say, I want to inquire whether I will succeed without explaining whether I will succeed as a fugitive. He didn't have to tell the Kohen what he was doing. He could just use general terms, so Achimelech never finds out where David is going. But the point is that one reason for him to go to the Mishkan is in order to be able to get advice from God. He doesn't need to go there for bread and weapons. He can do bread and weapons somewhere else. But he needs to talk to God. That's number one. Number two, the second thing is, and this is what we've been building up to, is that he feels safe going to the Mishkan because nobody's there. As a general rule, no one is in the Mishkan. Because people have been abandoning the Mishkan since the time of Shiloh, number one. And because it's decentralized. You don't need to be at the Mishkan to bring a karban. You don't need to go to the Kohen Gadol. So he feels like he's relatively safe. He's not, because Doeg is there. But that's what David is thinking, and that's why he goes there. You follow? Yes, Janine.
Could he have thought that he would be safe with the Kohanim? I mean, did the Kohanim know what was happening?
So it's an interesting suggestion.
Because Shmuel...
It's an interesting suggestion. I would note two things, though. Number one, he doesn't tell the Kohanim what he's doing. So that calls into question. If he trusted them, why didn't he tell them what was going on? That's number one. Number two, the whole question of the Kohen Shmuel relationship is an interesting one to me. I forgot to mention in the beginning of class, so I'm going to mention it now. My Beit Midrash has two major programs coming up, Motzei Shabbos and Sunday. Motzei Shabbos, we have 7 in-person pre-Slichos classes. I put the flyer for it in the email that I sent out with the source sheet for today. You can catch 3 of those sessions online. They also have Zoom options for those who don't want to venture out. And then Sunday, we have Tishrei in a Day. We have 2 different portions. One is a morning portion, from 10 o'clock to 1. And then the other portion is in the afternoon, 4:30 to 7:30. 12 different classes about Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and I really, really hope to see you. I hope that you'll be able to participate for at least part of it. I have already prepared my first class for it, and I really like it. The one about Jebel Muntar. I really, really like that class. I haven't finished the second one yet, but that's what I'm coming back to with Janine. Thank you for reminding me about the programs. Because in that class, I'm going to be talking about the Avoda of Yom Kippur and the way we read about it in our davening. And I was looking at comments by Rabbi Jonathan Sachs in his Machzor, and he notes there the division between the Avoda in Musaf and the Slichos. And he links it to the difference between the Kohen and the Prophet. So that's what you just reminded me of. We don't really know the relationship between the Kohanim and the Nevi'im so well. It's not so clear. But David, I don't think, trusted them, or he would have said something. Susan and then Jeanette.
I'm kind of wondering how David is not sort of looking at God and saying, you came a couple, I don't know how long it was, and you anointed me privately, but you had Shmuel anoint me. Now you're putting my life in jeopardy. What's going on? Why these trials to see if I'm good enough to be a king?
That is an excellent question. That is what marks David as special. Right there, what you just identified is what marks David as unique. When you learn through Tehillim, you find that David asks questions of God, but David never rejects God no matter what. Every time he's in trouble, he'll say, right, we have that parak that people associate with Esther, Kaylee, Kaylee, lama azavtani, why have you left me? We have that line where he says, God, it looks like you've abandoned our troops, what's going on? Lo seitzei lo kimbitzei voseinu. But David is understood to be with God no matter what.
Is this like your Eov? No matter what.
Well, it's not, because Eov accuses God of being the enemy.
But he never stopped believing it.
Right, correct. And thank you for mentioning that, because God willing, on next Tuesday at this time, 1:30 to 2:30, I'm going to be teaching a class about that and Eov and how it relates to our Rosh Hashanah. Hopefully you've seen that flyer as well. So that's Tuesday afternoon. This Zoom, by the way, same address. Even though it's a different link, it's the same address at the end. It's the same Zoom. You should register, please. So yes, please do that. Look at the flyer. It was in the email that I sent out this morning, my Beit Midrash weekly email. Wow, we're getting a lot of PR in here for programs. Jeanette.
So what I was going to to say, it's just interesting that Susan brought that up, because it kind of is a segue. What you said is what makes David HaMelech like one of my three favorite people in the Tanakh, is just like his acceptance of whatever happens to him and his looking at the good whatever happens to him. But what I was going to say is that even though this visiting Nov seems like a strange thing for somebody who's on the run to do, it in a way shows exactly that he's doing a tikkun for what Shaul did. That Shaul did not think, what does God want me to do? And David HaMelech is starting off saying, what does Hashem want me to do? That's
right.
Another thing that kind of personifies who he is.
Right.
There were mistakes that are made that I'm sure we're going to deal with next week.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, you know, he never imagines what would happen.
Right.
Even though Shaul turned against him, he never thought that he was risking the safety of the Kohanim.
I think that's true.
I don't want to
put down Shaul, because
it was just a mistake. It was just like he made certain mistakes. As we talked about, his tragic flaw was that he didn't think every step of the way, am I doing exactly what Hashem wants me to do? He was a good person with a good heart at the beginning. I'm not an anti-Shaul person, but I feel like David kind of learned, and David corrected that in starting off going to the Kohen Gadol and trying to figure out what it was. It's true.
I think it's a good point. Thank you. So what we've seen at this point, other than the review of chapter 20, is that this is really a chapter about David. David is going to have to do some terrible things in order to survive as a fugitive. And he goes to the Mishkan first because he wants to consult with God, which, as Jeanette notes, is a corrective, in a sense, for Shaul's mistakes of taking decisions into his own hands. And he feels safe going to the Mishkan because no one's going to the Mishkan at this point. Avoda is decentralized. The service is decentralized. And because they have a long practice at this point of not going to the Mishkan. God willing, we will pick up here next week. I hope to see you. If not Saturday night, then Sunday and Tuesday afternoon next week. There's even a Wednesday morning class. There was a flyer for that as well. We've got loads of learning to do in the run-up to Rosh Hashanah. Thank you very much.